This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 341 was recorded on September 15th, 2022. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Bianco Research founder Jim Bianco returns as this week's feature interview guest. Jim and I will revisit the inflation debate, and Jim says inflation isn't going away anytime soon. We'll also discuss the equity market outlook, precious metals, and much more. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick's chart deck will be titled, Did the Next Down Leg Begin? It seems a few listeners misread our intent when Dr. Anas Alhaji and I jokingly exchanged a few comments at the end of last week's feature interview, disagreeing about the need for a strategic petroleum reserve. Folks, please rest assured that Anas and I are good friends and there's no rift between us. We're just joking around. But since there does seem to be listener interest, Anas and I have agreed to do a Twitter Spaces in coming weeks to discuss why our views differ on the SPR and to explore some other issues we didn't have time for in last week's feature interview. We'll announce that follow-up conversation with Anas here on Macro Voices before it happens.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, S&P 500, we've got a market that broke pretty badly on the inflation numbers. It's a week today, but it's really hasn't followed through some, but we are under 4,000. What's your take on this market?
Well, I think we need to really ask ourselves why, Patrick, so many people are so complacent that inflation is just certain to be something other than a new secular trend. Nobody seems to want to believe the possibility that we've had 10 years of policy that have all led to a tipping point where I think we're in a new secular inflation. Almost nobody sees it that way in institutional finance. Everybody's waiting for that Fed pivot that they just think has to be around the corner. And I don't think this should be a great surprise. It was a huge, huge surprise. Well, why was it a surprise? It's very consistent with what the trend has been in inflation. It's just nobody wants to get the memo that this is the trend. So markets don't seem to have the memo. I still can't explain the strength in this equity market. I do want to be clear, though, that my predictions last week, where I made some pretty dire calls about an energy crisis, food crisis, and continued escalation of geopolitical crises around the world, I think those things are set to worsen. Now, in any normal, sane interpretation of economics, you'd think that would necessarily predict a stock market crash. I want to be clear that I'm not predicting that. I certainly don't rule that out. I think we could be right on the hairy edge of a really big down move in markets right here, right now. But frankly, we've been surprised over and over again as the belief in the central bank put always seems to restore the markets to new all-time highs when I don't think it's possible. So I'm not making any predictions for equity markets here, other than I don't think that this market understands yet that inflation is not going away.
All right, we'll talk more about that in the post-game, but let's move on to that dollar index, which broke higher. We're edging toward that 110 level once again. Is there still another leg higher in the dollar in your mind?
Well, we had a brief dip down to 108, and then we're right back up to 110. There's no bear market here. I think it's just another dip, and this dollar strengthening trend, I think, is set to continue.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil. We edged toward $90 on that October contract, and today a bit of a sell day back towards 85. But so it seems like oil's struggling to kind of reverse this downtrend. Is it still vulnerable to go a little bit lower in your mind?
Oh, I think it could go to a new low. I think it's entirely possible. Let's start with EIA inventory. Now, what really happened this week was a massive drawdown, and it's a drawdown after Labor Day, after summer driving season is over, of 6 million barrels. The thing is, it didn't get reported that way because of that 6 million barrel drawdown, really 8.4 million was drawn out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. The result is that what gets printed on the report is a build of 2.4 million barrels. barrels. That's because of the SPR. And that was, I believe, the largest weekly draw, 8.4 million barrels, ever in the history of the SPR. It's the most ever to come out in 1 week, so far as I know. And obviously, that has offset what would have otherwise been a 6 million barrel drawdown this week. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 135,000 barrels. Gasoline drawing down 1.8 million barrels. The only build on the board was distillates with a great big 4.1 million barrel build. Looks like the rail strike has probably been averted. That should also help to replenish distillate inventories. A lot of people thought that there would be weakening demand for diesel fuel in as a result of the rail strike. That looks like is probably not going to happen. U.S. production staying flat at 12.1 million barrels, unchanged from last week. Tape action after the data came out was right up to the 200-day moving average, saw a nice rally there and then stalled. Prices started to trade off. Then we got news from the White House that they made a very surprising announcement saying that they plan to start replenishing the Strategic Petroleum Reserve when the spot price of oil hits $80. And of course, it was just above that. Now, that effectively put a floor on the market. Traders heard that and said, okay, we know there's a buyer at $80. You know, it's safe to buy here. So I don't think that the White House, maybe in their efforts to try to show the public they're doing something by making this announcement, really considered what the effect of the announcement would be on the market and how it might actually be contrary to their goals. My view is that buying this bottom, the bottom as we get to the global recession, pushes oil prices down, and eventually we realize that we still have a really serious supply problem and a global energy crisis that will push them back up. There's a bottom in there somewhere. Wherever it is, I think it's the trade of a lifetime to buy it. The problem is the bottom already in, or is it $20 lower from here? Nobody knows, Patrick. It's going to depend on the data. It's going to depend on the sequence of what happens when. Do we get more big, ugly recession data and inflation data first, or do we get more supply constraint in the physical market news next? Eventually, this all is going to resolve to much higher energy prices, but there's plenty of room to go lower from here. And it looks like just this afternoon, you know, it's a pretty significant downward pressure there. It took us below the short-term moving averages. We're still speaking before the close. We might recover the 8-day moving average at 86.06 before the close, but it's looking iffy. And if we don't, that would be a close below all three of the short-term moving averages, suggesting further downside to come. So I don't know what's next. I think that it's not what comes next, but what comes two or three steps down the playing board, so to speak, that I'm most interested in. And that's going to be a move much higher in oil prices. But you can't afford to bet with leverage here and not be ready for some significant turbulence before we get there.
All right. Well, let's move on to gold, because for 2 weeks, gold has been relatively quiet, trading sideways, holding above 1700. And just a few hours before we started recording, we got a nasty break. Not only are we below 1700, but now multi-year lows as we break to 1675, breaking those 2021 and 22 lows. What's going on in gold in your mind?
Well, we hit a 1668 handle at one point today, just barely recovering off of that. And as I tweeted earlier today, you know, the mechanism of injury is very easy to understand here. You have a great big surprise inflation print. That means everybody expects the Fed to continue hiking, to continue being aggressive with monetary policy. It means the dovish pivot that everybody was expecting isn't going to come as soon as they expected. And that means that you're going to see higher real interest rates. Higher real interest rates are bad for gold. It comes as no surprise whatsoever that gold sold off hard in reaction to the last couple of days' worth of news. But take a big step back and look at the big picture, especially if you've bought into any of the gold bug rhetoric that's that we've all been conditioned with for years and years about someday, you know, the central banks are going to debase fiat currency and the market's going to realize that gold is the only answer and the dollar's on the way out and everybody's going to rush to gold as the safety trade and it's going to be this massive profitable speculation. It's just not playing out that way. There's still a very good argument to be made for holding physical gold outside of the financial system if you really fear the absolute doomsday scenario of the entire fiat monetary system completely collapsing so that, you know, currency is worthless and you know, the only thing that has value anymore is gold coins, cigarettes, and scotch whiskey. If it gets to that point, having GLD shares or anything like that is not going to help you. You're going to need the physical metal. And in that scenario, silver is probably a better choice than gold anyway. But as far as the macro speculation that gold should fare extremely well as we get into a period of oncoming secular inflation, as we see central banks really addicted to printing money and debasing the currency, all that stuff that the gold bugs predicted was going to take us to $5,000 or $10,000 gold has already happened, and we're not going anyplace. So gold is acting as a currency and nothing more, and I think we have to just take it at face value for what it is. It's not the magic hedge that so many people thought it was going to be against so many different things.
Well, let's wrap by talking about that 10-year treasury yield, because we're right back up to 2022 highs, just edging towards that 3.5 level. Are we in for some higher yields here?
It sure looks that way, and it makes sense in the back of this inflation print. It's no surprise that everybody is panicking and saying, oh, wait, you know, we thought that surely the inflation had to have peaked and that was going to set things up for the Fed to dovishly pivot. Those trades are all off the table now. People are saying, oh, wait a minute, it's not going that way. As you say, Patrick, we're right back to 3.5% on the 10-year yield, or just barely testing it. If we close over 3.5% on the 10-year yield, which would mean a lower price on bonds, higher yield, that really is a pretty significant signal that this backing up of yields is going to continue. Well, how far can it continue before it breaks a whole bunch of other things with higher interest rates? And certainly, what's going to happen to the housing market, the rate-sensitive portion of the housing market, which is most of it, is really getting challenged with much higher mortgage rates, and it's making homes less affordable. So there's going to be a huge backlash into housing, and that in turn has the potential of providing a feedback loop into the general economy. So there's lots and lots of danger as we get north of 3.5%, especially if we get over 4%. Let's see what happens.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is Bianco Research founder Jim Bianco. Eric, we got Jim back. Why did we get him on the show this week?
Well, Jim is one of our favorite guests in general. He's a brilliant macro guy. Fixed income focus is particularly relevant this week, given the discussion that we just had about treasury yields. We'll go much deeper with Jim on where this is all headed and what it means. But particularly, Jim is also, you know, the guy that really saw the pandemic coming and so forth. And at this time when I think we're on the cusp of energy and food crises and so forth, I'm talking about some pretty bold calls here. I wanted to get a level-headed guy who's looked at serious problems before and gotten the calls right and see how Jim sees these things.
Well, Eric's interview with Jim Bianco is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
If you invest to bring about a world powered by green energy, you should meet Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy that serves as a one-stop shop for green energy investors in Europe. Respect Energy brings together independent power producers, accredited and institutional investors holding assets in renewables or undertaking investments in new green energy production, such as wind and solar photovoltaic power plants. More than 600 institutional and accredited investors have already entrusted Respect Energy with the sale of their electricity production, portfolio management, O&M services, EPC, and project development. If you want to invest in green energy in Europe with the help of a trusted partner, contact Respect Energy today and ask for a tailor-made solution. For more information, visit respect.energy.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Bianco Research founder Jim Bianco. Jim, it's great to get you back on the show. I want to start with something that's really been bugging me, because as I try to figure out the equity market and just the general macro landscape, I can't reconcile this thought that I've had for more than a decade now, which is I always said, what's eventually going to break things and bring about the end game is when inflation finally starts to run away, because that's what will tie central bankers' hands, and suddenly we won't be able to paper over all of our problems with printed money anymore. I'm shocked. First, I was ridiculed for even thinking inflation could ever come back. And now that we've got it, it doesn't seem like anybody sees it the way I do, which is this is a fundamental game changer. It means that the bailout mechanism isn't going to work anymore. I don't perceive most market participants really seeing the situation that way. So it makes me wonder if I've got it wrong. What do you think?
No, I don't think you've got it wrong. I think a lot of people are in that camp that, you know, as I've liked to call them, the last year's transitory inflation is this year inflation has peaked crowd. If you look at surveys of central bankers, you know, their outlooks or Wall Street's outlook, there's a common theme no matter what developed country you look at. Everybody's got inflation peaking about now, and they've all got inflation returning to 2% in the next 18 to 36 months, depending on who you're looking at. But what they all have is inflation is, they believe, a one-time surge because of the pandemic reopening, and then it will go away forever. And they're still using the playbook of the 25 years through 2020. Whenever there was a problem, including 2020, and it looked like the world was going to end in March or April of 2020, here come the central bankers. And if the Fed has to buy $100 billion worth of bonds a day, which is what they were doing at one point, they will levitate markets and they will make every problem go away. So that's where that complacency is. This inflation is a one-time thing. It's going to go away. The printing presses could come, the fiscal authority could come, or maybe they'll change the rules or whatever, and whatever perceived concerns or problems we have will disappear, so don't worry about it.
It seems like very few people are even concerned that, well, what if the inflation doesn't go away and central bankers' hands continue to be tied, and essentially the Fed put is permanently expired? Is that the right way to think of this, and why aren't people more concerned about it?
Because, again, they don't think that inflation is a problem. For 40 years, inflation was not a problem. And I think the single most difficult thing for people to understand is we've had a secular change around the pandemic. Now, pandemics typically, it didn't cause anything new to happen. It sped up a lot of basic trends that we've seen in the marketplace. You know, what was it that held down inflation? There was three things that held down inflation. There was cheap labor, and cheap labor came about because of either immigration in the United States or globalization. Your job was always at risk that somebody would come in from a foreign country and do it at a lower price. Maybe not your job, but maybe two levels below you. And then that would lower their pay, which would lower the next level, which would lower your level, and everybody's pay would go down. Or there was a worker in another country that we could send your job to that would do it cheaper. Now, that has been questioned because post-pandemic, workers have a newfound power. They're willing to work from home. They're willing to quit their jobs, the great resignation. They're willing to, you know, not be as acquiescent to management as they used to be. And again, you could see this with the whole work from home fight in the developed world right now, where managers and employers are begging people to come back to the office and they're not. So cheap labor seems to be one that's not in the cards anymore. The unemployment rate for the moment is 3.7%. And the Atlanta Fed has this thing where they wage tracker, where they say that if you switch jobs, your pay is up 6.7% in the last year. But if you don't switch jobs, your pay's up 4.9% in the last year. And that's the widest spread ever. So there's a huge premium on quitting and switching and looking for new jobs. So cheap labor's gone. That was the thing that held down inflation. Cheap goods. China, for over the last 40 years, we got $6 trillion with a T dollars worth of goods from China collectively. And most of that is all cheap stuff. $9 trillion from the Pacific Rim. So two-thirds of it was China. So while people weren't getting raises, and that did lead to a populist movement at times, the Tea Party movement, Occupy Wall Street, Trump, Brexit, we were also offsetting that with ever cheaper stuff. And that seems to be at an end now too. China's got zero COVID. Their economy is really struggling badly right now. They might have negative GDP for only the second time in 40 years. The first time was the pandemic in 2020, but that was an artificial shutdown. This one is not going to be because of an artificial shutdown like 2020. And they've also got political tensions higher between China and the U.S. than any time in the last, maybe in my lifetime, you know, with the CHIPS Act, with $50 billion to bring semiconductor manufacturing back in the United States. And just as we're recording the week before, the Biden administration putting more restrictions on high technology and semiconductors being shipped to China. So they're not a reliable source of cheap goods anymore, which also held down inflation. And the third one, more for Europe, is cheap energy. Europe has their manufacturing base was really benefiting from cheap natural gas from Russia. Zoltan Pozsar of Credit Suisse has a great statistic that he's pointed out in some of his recent writings. In a year, Germany would get $27 billion of cheap energy from Russia, and that would be the backbone to create $2 trillion worth of cheap goods. Think about the amount of energy it takes to build a Mercedes in Stuttgart. And now think about a 600% rise in natural gas and what that's going to do to the cost basis of building a Mercedes. And so what you've seen is the current account deficit in Germany plummet since the war began because these high energy costs are killing their manufacturing base. So those were the bedrocks of why we had no inflation for 40 years, and they're all disappearing. And that's where I think people are struggling. They all say, no, this is just a one-time thing because of the pandemic. We're going to go right back to 2020 or 2019. But I don't think we are. I think we've got to start to realize that there are secular changes that have come in play. And yes, we might not be in a persistently 9% inflation world. If we are, we're in a deep world of hurt. But we might be in a persistently 4 or 5% inflation world. And that's not a good place to be. Because that means neutral on interest rates is probably 5 or 5.5%, and restrictive on interest rates is something higher than that. And those are numbers that the market is just not ready to accept.
Jim, let's take those three things, cheap labor, cheap goods, and cheap energy, and drill down on each one of them, because I think there's a fascinating story on each one, particularly on the labor side. I can't figure this out yet, because what I've noticed is it feels to me like almost everybody has had an attitude change personally as a result of the pandemic. Some of those people seem to be more ambitious and less risk averse. I see more people that might have been afraid to leave their employer who wants them to return and doesn't like their work from office and just say, you know what, I'm going to start my own business. I'm going to create my own thing. I'm going to continue working at home. I like this. I don't need that job with Goldman Sachs anymore. I can start my own, you know, wealth management firm in my house or something. So there's that crowd, but there's also a new trend that a lot of people are talking about called quiet quitting, where especially a lot of low-income earners have just reached a point, I think, of disenchantment after going through the pandemic and everything, where they just feel like they can't get ahead and they're just not really doing their jobs anymore. They go to work and do the absolute minimum. They know that with a labor shortage, it's very unlikely they're going to get fired, and they just don't care anymore. So it seems like some people are interpreting it one way, some people are interpreting it another way, but almost everybody's attitude is changing. What does this mean for investments, and why are all these attitudes changing, and where do you think it's all headed?
So you're right. I think that the attitudes are changing. You know, people would say, you know, you are defined by your job, and, you know, some of us still are, but a lot of people, they've decided, you know, during the pandemic that they're not. They're not going to be defined by their job anymore. And that's either through quiet quitting or through the great resignation that they're going to seek out a job that's more convenient for their lifestyle. I think we underestimate shutting down the economy globally, what it did for people in 2020. It's almost like economically we had a near-death experience. And coming out of a near-death experience, we have a different attitude and a different outlook on life. And maybe this is not life, but this is maybe more of our economic life that we've got a different outlook on. So you're right that these are going to have huge implications. One of them is going to be for the commercial real estate markets worldwide. What do we need offices for? We probably still need a reason for people to aggregate together and to work together, but maybe not in the form that we did. The second one is about hiring and retaining talent and what we're going to need to do to hire and retain talent. So I think that we are in, like I said, we are in a period of epic change. Nick Bloom of Stanford University, you know, I kind of riffed on this a minute ago. He summed it up well. He said that before the pandemic, we had maybe 5% of the workforce was remote and working from home, and that was rising and or working from home, and that was rising at about 0.5% a year. Now we're at around 20%. So what we did is we jumped ahead 20 to 25 years. Now we were going to get here anyway, but we were going to have 20 years to figure out how to adjust to it. Now it all came in a very fast period. That's what I, again, I mentioned this before, what I think this pandemic has done. It hasn't created a new trend. It took the trends, especially cheap labor, and it sped them up. And that's what I think we're really struggling with. Again, the other thing is, I think after decades and decades of mismanagement of large cities, that one of the other problems people have is getting to an office is not a pleasurable experience. So if you live in New Jersey and you've got to take the New Jersey path through the Port Authority and then jump on a bus in New York City to get to your office, that is a terrible experience. And that experience is a big deal for you when you're deciding where you're going to work. And so I think employers having a difficult time understanding this is a different era. For sure, Wall Street is having a difficult time with this. Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, all after Labor Day made a big push to get everybody back into the office 5 days a week. And by every indication, they're getting enormous pushback on that. Now, in the past, if the management of Goldman Sachs said, all you people that work at Goldman, we want you to jump, the answer was how high? And now when we say we want you to jump, there's like, well, I'll do it from home. And so there's been a big change up and down the line.
Let's move on to the second item, cheap goods. I guess what doesn't add up to me is so many people are saying, look, it's just a matter of time. As soon as the pandemic supply chain issues resolve, the goods are coming back down. Just relax. And I'm like, wait a minute. The labor's going up and the energy's going up. Aren't those the input costs to making the goods? Am I missing something?
No, you're not. And then there's the other thing too, is that we have to understand that we are in the West and we think like Westerners. And from the moment that China put zero COVID on, every Westerner told me, oh, they're going to get rid of it. It's just too bad for their economy. It's going to be terrible. And the original idea was they're just doing this for the Olympics. And as soon as the Winter Olympics end in February, they're going to get rid of the zero COVID. This is just to make things look good for the global event. Well, that came and went. Zero COVID never went anywhere. Then you throw in all of the political strife that they're having with the West as well. And I think the answer is they just view things differently than we do. See, in the West, we think everything has to be oriented towards economic growth. And everything we do has to be for an end of creating more economic growth. I just don't think they think that way right now in China. So if their economy is struggling and they're in a battle with the West over political tensions, they're going to win that fight. And if they have to hurt their economy to do it, they are. And that's part of what zero COVID looks like it is. At a minimum, it's just the Communist Party exerting control over their populace that we can fix this. See, that all these million people died in the U.S., but that's not going to happen here because we're a better system. And if that means we have to wreak havoc on our economy, we wreak havoc on our economy. So I just think that a lot of people are not really understanding the mindset. And you just look at what's been happening in there between the political strife and everything else. Bottom line is you don't have a stable source of goods. Second of all is the supply chain. Oh, once the supply chain fixes itself, it'll be all okay. The World Bank and S&P Global rank the 370 largest ports in the world in terms of efficiency. The least efficient port, ranked 370, is the Port of Los Angeles. 369 is the Port of Long Beach. 368 is the Port of Savannah, Georgia. 367 is the Port of Vancouver, Canada. Right above that is Morocco, Nairobi, and the Congo. The Congo. So we have to send people from LA to the Congo to learn how to do port management better because, according to the World Bank, they're more efficient than the US. Now, what does that mean? We have a brittle, inflexible supply chain system. So when you have the pandemic shutdown, reopening, taste change, preferences change, it can't handle it. That's why it is chronically short, why it chronically has problems. The day we're recording, there's talk that there might be a big rail strike in the US. If there is, it will create absolute havoc on the supply chain again, because there's no way to, there's no flexibility in the system in order to change or to compensate for something like that. And so I think what this is the part that people miss is that things have changed. Our supply chain cannot. And so we've got this chronic problem that needs to be dealt with. And it needs to start with, we have a bad system. And the system needs to be refined and fixed. And yet we're just, Wall Street's argument is, yeah, just wait. It'll fix itself and go magically go away by itself.
The third factor that you described was energy. This one strikes closer to home for me because that's what I trade. And boy, on this one, as our regular listeners know, I've looked at this really carefully, Jim, and it seems to me, although the formative global energy crisis is curable, I understand exactly what needs to be done to fix it. Those solutions would take a minimum of 5 years to implement, and we haven't started yet. So it seems guaranteed to me that we have an energy crisis at least for the next 5 years, probably the next 10. What are the implications of that on this whole inflation story?
Oh, it's big. And just on the
energy. And do you disagree on the energy? I mean, I want to get your
view on that. No, I don't disagree. I want to give one nuance to the story. Let's divide the energy world, the energy markets, into two basic broad categories: the fungible energy markets and the more less fungible energy markets. So less fungible energy markets are natural gas. There's a bunch of pipelines that go from Russia to Europe to supply them with cheap natural gas. And Putin has been closing the spigot on that in a tit for tat. Remember that in February and March, the US, or not the US, but the West in general, they froze the assets of the Russian Central Bank. They kicked them out of the SWIFT system. And they said, look, you know, we've got all of these tools in a hyper-financialized world that we could punish Russia with. And they almost like didn't think to himself, well, he's got a tool on the other side. He's got his hand on this gas spigot and he can close it. And the problem there is that natural gas isn't quite as fungible. You know, oh, well, if Russia's going to, you know, not send their natural gas to Europe, they'll send it to China and then China will resell it to us. Look at a map. If you look at the Siberian natural gas fields, how long of a pipeline do you have to make to send gas from Siberia to China? The answer is the same distance as it is from Alaska to Miami. How long is that going to take you to build that pipeline? Many, many, many years. This is not going to happen anytime soon. LNG, liquefied natural gas on a boat? Well, we're already running at capacity now. How fast can you build boats and terminals? Many, many years. So that non-fungible market is in a world of hurt, and that's why you've seen these skyrocketing prices. The fungible market is the crude oil market. Most of those cargoes go by sea. They could be redirected anywhere else. And let me go back to what we were talking about earlier. China, the second largest economy by gross domestic product, is now near zero growth. It used to be 6 or 7% growth. Where would crude oil prices be if we didn't have huge demand destruction out of China right now? They'd be a lot higher. So we're benefiting, I think, from some short-term stuff like the SPR releases and stuff, but bigger picture, the Chinese demand is not there. So the non-fungible markets is where we're seeing it. You can't just take gas and just turn it into LNG, put it on a boat, send it somewhere else, problem solved. You can do that with crude oil because almost all of it goes by cargo ship somewhere and you can redirect those cargo ships to other places. So yes, I do think that we do have an energy problem. I do think that that energy problem is going to be with us for a long time. I think that people like Russia is opening OPEC's eyes to reminding them what the 70s were like, that they had a weapon of energy usage that or energy supply that they could use, which Russia is using, and I unfortunately think effectively against Europe to offset some of their sanctions. And so that this problem is not going to go away. Now, what does it mean? As I mentioned before, the single biggest input to any manufacturing process is cheap energy. Then comes cheap labor, well in a distance. So if you're building that car, to use my example before, that Mercedes in Stuttgart, you're building that car, you need cheap energy. You don't have it. That is a huge problem for manufacturing in Europe. And eventually, if they're going to get their gas from LNG transports or cargoes from the United States and everywhere else, you recently saw natural gas at a 14-year high in the United States. Now, not the nosebleed levels we've seen in Europe, but that's going to bleed through to manufacturing processes here and everywhere else, that higher energy inputs are going to drag on everything and cause everything to become more expensive.
I want to integrate these ideas now, Jim, because we've started with the idea that there's a massive complacency among market participants. And that complacency is people feel like, hey, we know from a whole generation of trading now that anytime anything really bad goes wrong, central banks come rushing into the rescue. They print up a bunch of money. They paper over our problems by bailing things out. And I think we've established the reasons that that doesn't really work if there's inflation. We've then discussed that everybody seems to think the inflation is not going to be persistent, yet we've just gone through a whole bunch of reasons that it seems like it almost has to be. So how do we reconcile all this? Is there some moment of awakening where the whole market says, oh my gosh, inflation really is persistent, that really does tie central bankers' hands, and you know, all of a sudden equity markets crash? Or, I mean, what happens? How do we get from, it seems like the market is out of touch with the market right now?
Like I said, I think it's more of a debate between those that think it's just like the last 25 years, you know, that there will be a solution at the end of the day. I've heard people say this to me. They were kind of half joking, but half not. Oh, don't worry about the European energy problem. And I said, yeah, but they did. They met in Brussels last week and they couldn't come to an agreement. And they said, yeah, because it's not 40 degrees outside. You wait till it's 40 degrees outside and they give them a little bit of urgency, they'll fix the problem. How are they going to fix the problem? They always do. Now, I don't want to be dismissive of that idea because that from about 1995 to 2020, that was the exact way that pretty much every problem worked its way out. And what you point out correctly is what underpinned all of those ideas that you could just print your way out, change the rules, fiscal expansion, whatever it takes to give a problem away, never had inflation. But now that we have inflation, the big argument is inflation a bigger problem or a more persistent problem because of cheap energy, cheap labor, and cheap goods? There's a debate right now on Wall Street, and most of Wall Street does not think that this is a secular change. Now, part of that might be that everybody's been so ingrained with the most expensive words on Wall Street are this time is different. And you're right. Every time people say this time is different and it isn't, it's very expensive for your trading account. Except when it is different and you don't recognize that it is, that is devastating for your trading account. So I think over time, as this persistent inflation continues, it's going to become more problematic. Now, let me diverge here real quick, Eric, and go off into one other quick thing on this subject. Let me talk about the Federal Reserve. The way I see the Federal Reserve when it comes to this inflation topic, I think there's two broad camps at the Fed. I think Jay Powell is in a camp that is probably more aligned with the persistent inflation problem. Augustin Karstens is in that camp. He's the head of the Bank of International Settlements. He gave a speech at Jackson Hole, the luncheon speech after the morning speech that Jay Powell gave, that pretty much laid out a lot of what I just said. And I think that Powell is in that camp. I think that Isabel Schnabel of the ECB is in that camp, and some of others are. But on the other side, I think that there is Lael Brainard, there's the staff of the Federal Reserve, and maybe Christine Lagarde, who are not in that camp, that they are still of the belief that this is a one-time pandemic rise of inflation and that it will go away. And this is part of the problem because when the central bankers, when Jay Powell comes out and gives his 8-minute speech This is it. There will be no pivot. There will be the market still prices in a pivot, and the market rallies a week and a half later because it says the Fed's going to pivot because there's enough people on both sides of the camp that you get a mixed message. But ultimately, it is the chairman of the Federal Reserve that believes that inflation is persistent. And I think that is going to win the day in the long run, that people are going to have to come to understand gone are the days of 2% inflation, gone are the days of 1% to 2% interest rates, and that we have to now understand that we are in a higher interest rate regime.
Jim, I want to go back to what you said about if the you say this time is different and it really is different that and you didn't anticipate it, you're really in trouble. I think it really is different this time, and it's actually not really different. It's just a bigger wave. You know, when we say that it's not different this time, what we've been talking about is there's no inflation. Well, wait a minute. In longer term waves, there have been big waves of inflation like the 1970s, and I think the beginning of the next one is already upon us. So if I tell you, I do think that it's different this time in the sense that the next secular inflation cycle that everybody thought would never come back again, because you know it was never ever going to come back, I think it is back because it always comes back every few decades. What does that mean in terms of what I need to do with portfolio construction and positioning? How do I reposition if I think this time really is different in the sense of we're beginning a secular inflation?
So first of all, you're right. Let me put a finer point on this time is different. What I said earlier, we've sped up the cycle. So what is happening was going to happen anyway. It just is coming on us at a much faster speed and a much greater change than we can handle. And I think, like I said, the catalyst for that was the lockdowns and the pandemic. But as far as portfolio management goes, I think that there's a couple of things that we have to kind of get our head around. Gone maybe are the days of just buy SPY, you're done, goodbye. In other words, buy the S&P 500, the market always goes up, the Fed prints money if they have to get the market to go up. I think we're going to be in a period of great change and a great turbulence. Now, that is not, I don't believe, a bearish scenario. I think that is a scenario of opportunity. We need to understand supply chains need to change. We need to find new sources of cheap energy. We need to find new sources of cheap labor. We need to find new sources of cheap goods. That presents opportunities in the manufacturing sector, in the industrial sector, in the transportation sector. That gives us more opportunities in the energy sector. Notice what I didn't say. I didn't say technology. Maybe what we're all waiting for is when is we going to get back to the days that the unprofitable tech, NASDAQ QQQ stocks go up 50%, 60% in a year, and a bunch of stocks that you know no one has ever heard of, you know, go up 20x, and they have something to do with the internet, or they have something to do with cloud computing, or something I don't understand, but they go up 20x. That era, I think, might be done. Now, that's not to suggest that those stocks are necessarily done, but I think that their heady valuations and their heady gains are behind us, and we're going back to stodgy old boring companies. You know, people that invest in the stock market, they get excited about Tesla and they get excited about Google and they get excited about Meta and they get excited about Zoom and stuff. But what's to get excited about manufacturing companies and industrial companies or Caterpillar, who makes just giant trucks that move earth? That sounds really boring, but that might be where we need to go. And a nice way to say this, if you will, is there has been, and as we've seen in the last year and a half, a shift back towards value stocks. And a lot of these companies are in the value bucket. And maybe that's really how people need to start thinking about things in terms of sectors, that we need to change things. We need to refine things as opposed to just wait for everything to be lifted at the index level. That worked great from 1995 to 2020. And that's also because we had no inflation from 1995 to 2020. But now we have chronic shortages. We have bottlenecks. We have problems. And we have inflation. And I just don't think that the same ideas and the same prescriptions that worked till 2020 are going to work moving forward.
Let's tie this in now with the military upset between Russia and Ukraine, because most people seem to be thinking about this as the Russia-Ukraine war, as if it's an isolated thing. Personally, I think this is the Russia-Ukraine battle, which just like the formative China-Taiwan battle are various different parts of a much bigger picture, which I think is all related. I think it's what Dr. Pippa Malmgren calls the new World War III, which is not being fought like World War II with soldiers and trenches and rifles. It's being fought on the cyber warfare battlefield. It's being fought on the economic warfare battlefield. But it's already begun, and it's a much bigger thing. Those are two radically different views. How do you see it? And do you think that this Ukraine thing is something that just, you know, needs a few more months to blow over and it's done? Or do you think that Ukraine-Russia is just a battle in the context of something much bigger, which is a secular change in the way world history is headed from here?
It's a battle in something much bigger, because let's go back to the beginning of the Ukraine war. What I saw that a lot of people saw that was extraordinary was the sheer level of Western sanctions on Russian companies. Everything from McDonald's closing 900 stores, you know, all the banks pulling out, everybody, you know, stopped doing business. Like I said, they got kicked off the Swiss system. They froze their central bank assets and the like. And here's the problem. And now we're seeing, as I pointed out, Russia's got some things that matter to us, like natural gas for Europe. But here's the problem. After 25, 35 years of globalization, an integrated, globalized economy, to have World War III fought at the cyber level or at the level that we have now, it's almost impossible to have this done, because there is a global supply chain. There is a global economy. And to disconnect one part of your economy from the other part, because we're going to take up sides in a war, is next to impossible to do. So we could all pat ourselves on the back that, you know, McDonald's pulled out of Russia to, you know, teach them a lesson. Of course, all those stores were reopened under a Russian name within a couple of weeks. But now we're starting to realize we can withhold money from them and they can withhold energy from us. And we both wind up being losers at the end of the day. This is very different. This is, you know, how are we going to fight a war? And you're right, not necessarily a shooting war, but an economic war with China, when all of the tools we're going to use, or not all the tools, but a good number of the tools we're going to use in that economic war come from China in the first place. We're going to turn around and use them against them, and vice versa. So this is a difficult new environment that we're still trying to get our head around. This is much more than an excursion into a bordering country, Russia into Ukraine, and meaning a lot more than that. I think we're right on that, but I think we're not appreciating the consequences of doing this in an integrated economic system, because what war suggests is we all need to isolate ourselves. We all need to have economic nationalism. It's impossible to have an economic nationalism when you're relying on your heat this winter from the country you're fighting with. And so this is something new and something different and something we have not experienced before.
So two views that it sounds like you and I definitely agree on, Jim, are number one, that the inflation is not likely to go away anytime soon, that it probably is going to be persistent and perhaps even secular and get worse over time. And the other is that this present military conflict is not just Russia-Ukraine, it's part of something bigger. Now, those are both non-consensus views, therefore variant perceptions that should create some alpha opportunity to make some money in the market if you see it different from the way the masses do. How do we translate this to actual views? Is this about interest rates going up? Is this about equities going down? What is it that we do to translate this variant perception to a market positioning?
Well, see, the thing about market positioning is, you're right. I mean, it is more value stocks. It is more industrial stocks. It's also more commodities. It's also looking for higher interest rates along the way. Now, a couple of things about that. The problem in commodity land, and especially the problem in energy, is for all of the listeners here that have never traded a cryptocurrency, if you trade energy, you're basically trading the same volatility as a cryptocurrency, because some of the volatilities that we've seen in energy have been, you know, they'll even make cryptocurrency traders blush, is what we've seen. So the point here is that a lot of people understand this idea that there might be a long-term secular play in commodities, but it's not going to come without a thrill ride or two or three because of a lot of the volatility that we've seen. Interest rates. Let me remind everybody who's been trading stocks for 15 or 20 years. Oh, interest rates have no value. They're too low. I hate the bond market. The bond market's going to do nothing but sell off. And I've been one who's tweeted out the charts over and over again that the total returns in the bond market year to date are some of the worst we've ever seen. See, you got to stay far away from the bond market. Okay, that's true. Except the bond market also has something that the stock market doesn't. It's senior in the capital stack, which means the bond market's going to get funded. And if it has to destroy everything in its wake to get funded, it will. If you think, and I don't mean this accusatory for anybody listening, let me say it differently. If you believe that, well, the bond market will just tank and rates will go up and who cares if you're trading commodities or stocks, without those funding costs staying at reasonable levels, then the stock market, commodity markets, and everything else are going to be in constant turmoil. So even though the bond market has problems in an inflationary environment where it needs to readjust to no more central bank buying of their bonds and higher interest rates at the same time, QT, if you will, and inflation at the same time, it will get funded. It does not go away. Yeah, you know, large parts of equity markets can go away, but it won't. So it will find buyers. As there's an old adage in the bond market, there are no bad bonds. There's only bad prices. And if the argument is we got bad prices, we'll just take prices on bonds lower and lower, interest rates higher and higher till they get funded. And if they, whoever they kill in their wake, in order to fund them, they kill in their wake. So be careful in the bond market. Now, eventually, and I think we might be within a year of this, rates will get to a point where the coupons will provide you with decent returns, regardless of where you think. Think of the 70s. If you go back and you look at the charts in the 70s, the bond market was, rates were going up and it was terrible. Yes, but coupons were so high, you always got a positive return from the bond market. So even if you bought them and rates went up, you lost on price, but you had such a big coupon. At the end of the year, you made money every year in the bond market. We might be close, maybe a year or two away from a period where we could say that about the bond market if rates keep going up. Yeah, it doesn't look good. Yeah, rates have to go up, but the coupons will offset the losses and you will be making money year in and year out. We cannot necessarily say that about other sectors in the market.
Jim, as I listen to what you're describing, what you say is ahead, it seems to me that everything the gold bugs ever told me was going to drive the price of gold bullion up to $5,000 or $10,000 an ounce either already happened, in most cases it already did, or it ought to be coming real soon based on what you're talking about. But price of bullion is really not going anyplace. Up a little bit in the last week, but still floundering, I would say, given everything that's going on geopolitically. Does gold just not work the way we were told it was supposed to work, or what's going on here?
Single most frustrating market to me has been the precious metals markets. Just to underscore what you said, you know, everything Peter Schiff ever wanted in life has occurred in the last 6 months. He's right. Everything he said was going to occur that was going to be bullish for gold, it has occurred. It has. I'm not trying to criticize him.
Well, the other way to look at it, you could reframe it as every single thing Peter Schiff ever predicted would send the price of gold to the moon all turned out to be wrong.
Right. Because all the things that he predicted that would send it to the moon, and it hasn't. So what I say, when I say I'm frustrated about it is I would have a year or two ago agreed with him. If A, B, C, and D and E happen, like you said, price of precious metals would go up, and A, B, C, D and half of E have happened, and the price of precious metals have done nothing. And it's been very frustrating to try and figure out what it is that the market needs or wants. Now, the best argument I could give you as to why precious metals aren't moving is, why do we own gold or silver in the first place? It's kind of a derivative of the crypto markets, right? It's a way to get your money out of the financial system or away from the financial system. So if there's a problem in the financial system, inflation, deflation, financial crisis, here's an asset that would be immune from it. But what have we done to precious metals over the last 30 years or 20 years? Is we financialize the hell out of them through derivatives, through ETFs, through futures, and everything else, so that if there is a problem in the financial system, then, you know, if the financial system catches a cold, gold and silver get pneumonia anyway. So all of a sudden, if they're not going to be immune, yeah, the financial system's got problems. Maybe the problems are inflation. Maybe the problems are a crisis like 2008. Then gold or silver should benefit because they're not part of the system. No, they are part of the system. They're squarely ensconced in the system. The biggest way that everybody, you know, I've had this argument countless times with people. Yeah, I like gold. I just bought GLD. Why? Because I'm worried about the financial system. You think GLD is going to survive if we have a problem with the financial system? It's just going to be a worthless piece of paper. But you know, you haven't gone and you haven't bought gold coins and put them in a safe deposit box. Oh, that's too hard. I don't understand how to do it. But not enough people have done that. So what we've done is we've financialized this system to such a degree, it can't escape the thing that it's supposed to benefit from, and that is problems within the financial system itself. That's the best answer I could give you. Because otherwise, I agree, everything that is happening should be bullish for precious metals, but yet they're not going anywhere.
Jim, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, please tell our listeners a little bit more about what you do at Bianco Research. Obviously, it is an institutional research firm, but even for our retail listeners, you do a tremendous amount of writing on various different channels. How can our listeners, both institutional and retail, follow your work?
Yes. So Bianco Research has been around for 24 years, and we are affiliated with an institutional bond brokerage firm called Arbor Research and Trading in the Chicago area. And our primary customer base is an institutional investor, primarily in the fixed income space, but not exclusively in the fixed income space. We don't have a retail product per se, so that is code word for it's a bit of an expensive product. But to offset that, I am very active in social media at Bianco Research on Twitter. We have a YouTube channel, Bianco Research YouTube channel. We also have, I'm on LinkedIn at my name, Jim Bianco. And, you know, I publish, I do op-eds, I do pieces from here and there to kind of give you the big picture ideas that we're trying to promote and where we're thinking. So if you follow us on any of the social media channels, you'll get an idea of where we are. But the nitty-gritty of, you know, the positioning and the specific ideas and the more detail, that's reserved for our institutional base.
Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this. After being completely sold out of advertising space for the last couple of years, we finally have capacity to add a new advertiser. Macro Voices has a Podtrac certified global audience of over 170,000 listeners, and each weekly episode typically gets 60,000 to 80,000 downloads. We have more than 20,000 accredited investors who have registered with us as accredited, and we estimate the total accredited investor audience as at least 40,000 accredited listeners, which we believe to be the highest number of accredited investor listeners of any podcast on the internet. We strive to accept tasteful advertising from advertisers whose product is likely to appeal to our audience. So we're looking for another investment or financial services advertiser to fill the space I'm speaking in right now. Mail order Viagra salesmen need not apply. If your company wants to advertise on Macro Voices, please email sponsorship@macrovoices.com for more information. Now let's get right back to the show.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Jim back on the show. What did you take away from the interview?
You know, I thought his comments on gold were particularly instructive. Gold is doing what it should be expected to do if you understand it as a currency that trades against the U.S. dollar. U.S. dollar is up for good reason. Gold is down for good reason. But if you go back to all of the rhetoric about how incredibly well gold was supposed to perform in an era of central bank currency debasement and so forth. Look, we got the prediction. It already happened. Gold didn't move. That it doesn't work that way. It's time to give up on that and reevaluate gold positions. I certainly am reevaluating mine. I haven't sold any gold yet because I do think that we're headed toward a really big escalation potentially of geopolitical tension, which should be good for gold. I don't think that right now, as we're touching a multi-year low, and of course, markets tend to, you know, want to shake out the weak hands. It's entirely possible that this is that last pulse lower before we eventually begin the grand gold bull market. But you know what? It isn't happening yet. And I'm getting less and less convinced that there really is a strong argument for gold beyond its obvious function as another currency. In any event, Patrick, let's move on to this week's post-game chart deck. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Click the red button that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, did the next leg down in markets already begin?
Well, you know, looking at page two, when we looked at that S&P 500, what we have to, you know, reflect upon is the fact that that July-August rally was simply a retracement. It went to retest the 200-day moving average, which has often been a very good arbiter of bull and bear markets. And the fact that the S&P rejected and started to sell into September was certainly the first clue that the primary downtrend is still intact. But what really was the big tell was the big rally we had leading up to the inflation number. We had a very oversold market. We talked about this idea that the market could get a relief rally, and it did, but it got above 4,100 on that bounce. But the inflation number reversed the trend back, got the trend right back down. And with the fact that every rally is being sold in lower highs, the primary downtrend remains quite intact. And obviously we have the option expiration coming up here this Friday, which is potentially going to hold the 3,900 level, which has a certain amount of strikes open there. But really, as we go into next week, the big question is will 3,900 hold? I mean, once we get under 3,900, not sure how we're not going to be double bottom testing 3,700 in a short order. And of course, once you have any sell cycle begin, you just really don't know Whether or not it can just build downside momentum in a liquidity event and do something that really surprises everyone. Nonetheless, the bulls are in bad shape here, and the charts are quite weak and vulnerable. And so we'll be watching going into next week whether or not that 3,900 gives out.
Now, Patrick, I just want to revisit the seasonality of really bad market years. Everybody remembers October, but in reality, the usual pattern is that you see the top, the short-term top, not necessarily the whole market top, but the recent top would come probably in August sometime. Then volatility really gets interesting in September, and then October is when the market finally puts the bottoms in and you get the really big sell-off. Kind of seems like we're following that plan here. If I look at your chart, August there was a top. It wasn't the total top of the market, but it was certainly the top for the last 6 months or so. And now all of a sudden it's September and volatility is picking up, isn't it? What comes next?
Well, you know what? I always have issues with following an analog by date because rarely are traders rewarded for something so obvious. But the big variables to me, obviously, are the midterm elections. Will that in some way change the pattern as we're moving here forward? The reality is this chart is very negative. But I still am, if I was to kind of speculate as one of the alternative scenarios to an outright crash is we come back, retest the double bottom, and then see a market that calms down back to 4,000 going into the midterm elections. It doesn't have to be all downside, but could just be a big grind as well. So I don't want to, I know that there's some big names out there calling for that 3,000 test on the S&P, and while it certainly would make sense for the S&P at some point to get down there, I would give it a very reasonable chance that previous low also holds. So certainly on the short term, I'm negative, but not completely convinced on a full leg lower here in September. Eric, the interesting thing I wanted to just add to that is on page 3, I have the volatility in the index, the VIX. And what is interesting is we haven't yet seen a proper bout of volatility spikes that typically is associated with, you know, a market fear and grabbing at premium to hedge downside risks. And while volatility has been following the vol path pretty clearly, and it's certainly nothing out of character, it is certainly in my mind, something that leaves lots of room for there to be one quick little washout to the downside of the market that is accompanied by some sort of a spike into the mid-30s. So it'll be really interesting to see whether that materializes.
Patrick, I think this is very much material to the title of this chart deck, which is Has the Next Big Down Leg Begun? You know, it would be tempting if you just looked at the size of that huge red candle on the S&P earlier this week when we got the inflation print, like, oh my God, this is it. This is the beginning. The sky's falling. Look at the size of that thing. But look, we got two more trading sessions under our belt now. We're just closing up the second one as we speak. And it's kind of stabilized. It hasn't continued. So it almost seems like we're back to this very orderly. The market has just discounted an unexpected result on the inflation print. It's priced it in, and it doesn't seem to be bringing a huge panic on the way I was afraid it was. Maybe in gold it's bringing on a panic, although it's kind of ironic that it's an inflation print that's bringing on a gold panic. But in equities, it doesn't seem like the panic is continuing, at least not in the last couple of days. But let's move on to the U.S. dollar, which is not quite on its highs, but it's almost back up to them. What do we see here?
Well, the upwards channel is intact. Higher highs, higher lows in an upwards trajectory. If it follows the pattern it's established, you know, a punch to a higher high toward 112 would seem like a very natural occurrence. It is interesting, though, that the U.S. dollar yen seems to have stalled out a little bit. But really, this, I think, will ultimately be as to whether the euro is making that journey down to like 97 cents. And so we'll be watching very closely as to what happens there. But what is interesting, if we go to pages 5 and 6, where I have the US dollar against the Canadian dollar, as well as the Australian dollar on page 6, what you can observe here is the fact that both of them are right at the edge. They've been going toward their key levels, and they're potentially both about to break out. And it'll be really interesting to see if that US dollar really gains some traction against these two cross currencies and whether they start contributing to a Dixie increase. Moving on, though, Eric, let's talk about that oil chart. You know, there was all sorts of headlines about whether the SPR was going to get replenished or not, which kind of gave oil a little bit of life. But so far, what we had was oil had a very clear breakdown below a pretty important support line that was established through July and August. And the entire rally that we had here in September has more or less stalled out on where all the previous lows were. And that is unfortunately a characteristic of a downtrend in this. And it really at this moment still makes oil vulnerable to some short-term weakness. Now, I get that bigger picture bull story on oil, but it really just doesn't seem like the chart wants to start doing anything bullish at this moment. It would be really interesting to see whether we have a downturn here that sees a very brief dip below 80. What's your take on crude?
Patrick, I think there's plenty of scope for a significant move down before we see a move up. And the thing you really have to understand is, what is the basis of my prognosis and Anas Al-Haji's prognosis and so forth for much, much, much higher oil prices to come? Well, the reason for that is that crude oil is famously demand inelastic, meaning that when the price increases, demand doesn't go down that much because most of the uses of crude oil are things that people have to have. They don't like it, but they have to pay for it. So that means that if we have a situation as we have right now, where it is impossible for the oil industry to supply the world with enough supply to get back to pre-pandemic normal, that means that as you try to get back to pre-pandemic normal, energy prices have to go to the moon, and they will. The thing is, we're not pushing to get to back to pre-pandemic normal. We're in a very difficult economic situation where the economy is floundering. The S&P is on the verge, it looks like, of breaking down to a new lower low. And we've got serious concerns about inflation plaguing the economy. There's lots of reasons to think that there's going to be enough demand destruction to hide the coming energy crisis, maybe for another year before it really kicks in. My very firm, high conviction contention here is that when demand tries to return to normal, there's not going to be supply there to meet it, and prices are going to the moon. But it looks to me like there's plenty of reason to expect demand to continue to come off, and that's going to hide this problem potentially for a while to come. Eventually, it's going to be much higher. Now, it will be very interesting to see whether the Biden administration changes their tune, because when they announced that as soon as we get down to 80, they're going to start buying to replenish the SPR, that kind of puts a floor under the market if people think they really mean it. So I wouldn't be surprised if after someone explains to the Biden administration how markets tend to interpret their comments, if they walked that back and said, well, that's not really what we meant. We meant that we would start considering it as we got well below 80, or, you know, who knows what they're going to say. So I don't know where this goes. I'm convinced that we are at the beginning of an energy crisis where energy and access to energy is going to be critical. And, you know, we could go for the next year without any really big run-up in prices, or Putin could pull half of his oil off the market tomorrow morning and we'd be at $150 before we know it. So it's very hard to tell what's going on here. And what that means is all the smart traders are saying, look, I know it's coming someday, but I can't afford, especially with this kind of huge volatility, I can't afford to put big positions on the table and speculate, because I don't know how long it's going to be until that outcome comes around. I certainly have dramatically reduced the amount of leverage in the longs that I'm still carrying in the crude oil market, because I know I have to be ready to ride out some really big vol swings. As long as people are thinking that way, there's not going to be a lot of speculative interest. It's the day that that changes and everybody starts to say, wait, things have stabilized. We now see that there is a clear path toward testing the limits of supply. I know what that's going to do. It's time to pile in on the long side of this trade. When that happens, it's going to be scary. But it could be 6 months to a year away for all I know.
All right. Well, let's move on to the gold chart. And really just the only thing here to highlight is that there's that clear breakdown of that July low. And more importantly, it doesn't show on the chart, but it's also the breaking of the 2021 lows. And this, in my mind, does open the window for a drop all the way towards 1600, which is just a reasonable first target, something somewhere, you know, 16.25 or something, just for the short term impulse. But it'll be really, I think, a story of when will the dollar top come in. Because if we have the dollar index heading up to 112, 113 and stays strong for months, well, then I think gold has even further potential weakness. I do think that there will be a pretty clear correlation and at least a window from which when the dollar inevitably hits its short-term high will mark where gold turns. And so right now, with the dollar remaining so strong, and immediate trend so distinctly in the favor of the U.S. dollar bulls, on the short term, gold weakening here is really the path to least resistance, and I'm anticipating a little bit more weakness here.
I agree, Patrick. And, you know, there's always scope to say that maybe markets love to just, you know, retest a low just before reversing higher, before a new structural bull market begins. You know, I think that would be wishful thinking in this case. It sounds good, but are there really catalysts in play for a new structural bull market to begin right here in gold? Or are we going to see a washout down to 1600 or maybe even 1400 before eventually this changes? And even then, what's going to change? The dollar will not be forever, but the dollar, I think, is going to last and appreciate longer than most people expect. We're going to see over the next few years that as the global economic situation and the geopolitical situation deteriorates, that the dollar is still the cleanest dirty shirt. It's the benefit of the safety trade. The dollar is going to appreciate. Someday it will be replaced with a digital currency system that will change the landscape forever. But that's still many years off. Patrick, you've got three charts pretty much using up the rest of the deck here, which show us different bond indices or different bond yield related instruments. What's going on here?
Let's start on page 9 with the 10-year U.S. Treasury bond yield, which, like we were talking about in the market wrap, is edging along that high. And to me, this is really interesting because if we have, let's say, bonds break down as the yield goes ripping north of 3.5, and then this trickles into the investment grade and high yield markets, which are on page 10 and 11, I don't know how the stock market doesn't take this poorly, particularly on page 11 when we look at the high yield junk bond market. It always has a strong correlation to equities. And the idea that, for instance, high yield junk is breaking to fresh lows and making another leg lower, and somehow the stock market is going to buck the trend, I'm a big seller on that. And so watching whether or not these bonds all start breaking, even investment grade bonds are about to make a fresh new low here, and watching whether or not there's another leg lower in bonds coming in early next week is on my mind. Because it's going to be really hard for the S&P 500 to hold up if this entire bond complex is taking another full leg lower.
Listeners, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can enjoy them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading, Patrick's trading service. You'll find the information on pages 12 and 13 of the chart deck, or you can just go to bigpicturetrading.com for a free trial. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we just discussed in the post game, as well as a number of links to articles that we found really interesting. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.